With the latest agriculture news from across the state and nation, it's time for the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. Here's your host, Sabrina Halvorsen.
Good morning, and thank you for joining us today on the AgNet News Hour. Coming up later, why some EPA Endangered Species Act proposals still need refinement, and there's a revised projection for 2023 food price inflation. But our top story today, retail fertilizer prices were a mixed bag again during the ending part of November, that according to sellers surveyed by DTN. Average prices for five of the eight major fertilizers were lower compared to last month, while prices for the remaining three fertilizers were slightly higher. The conflict in the Middle East has several energy markets on edge, including fertilizers. Andy Young, Vice President of Market and Strategic Analysis with Mosaic, is closely watching the situation between Israel and Hamas.
Well, the worst case scenario is pretty easy to draw up, that if there was a widening of the conflict and Iran in particular were to get involved, and you'd see a repeat of, you know, mines being laid in the Straits of Hormuz and choking off not just the typical oil products and hydrocarbon products that we think of, but all of the fertilizer and fertilizer-related raw material products that come out of the Middle East now. It is the world's largest supplier of a number of those fertilizer commodities, and that would be very dire from a fertilizer supply standpoint and therefore a food production standpoint.
If the region's fertilizer production is lost, it would create global shortfalls.
Nearly half of the world's traded urea comes out of the Middle East. About 40% of the sulfur emanates from the Middle East, as well as Egypt. For other commodities like phosphates, for potash, it's still a meaningful, you know, anywhere from 10% to 15% to 20%, depending on which product one looks at. So it's not easily replaced, or frankly, it cannot be replaced in the short term if it were to be choked off.
In other news, USDA has lowered its forecast for this fiscal year's U.S. agricultural exports. Gary Crawford reports.
In 2022, the U.S. exported $193 billion worth of ag products. Fiscal 2023, that dropped to just under $179 billion. And the new projection for fiscal 24?
$169.5 billion.
Meanwhile, USDA's chief economist Seth Meyer says while exports are falling, U.S. ag product imports could hit $200 billion for a $30 billion trade deficit. He says there are plenty of possible reasons for all of this.
Some might be the strength of the U.S. dollar. Some might be better performance of the U.S. economically than some of our trading partners around the world in terms of GDP growth. Some of it might be changes in the market and things we're always worried about, which is competitiveness.
Meyer says, though, the U.S. export number is still above historic averages, and basically
trade is still good, still strong, maybe not as robust as it was for a couple years.
And he says a lot can happen between now and the end of this fiscal year. Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
Bankers have had their voices heard in Washington, D.C., thanks to the American Bankers Association. They represent 83% of all banks nationwide and have agricultural loans in their portfolio. Ed Elfman is the Senior Vice President of Agricultural and Rural Banking Policy for ABA. He explains how he's supporting bankers and farmers with the upcoming farm bill.
One thing we're looking at, though, is this rising interest rate environment and what that means for farmers and ranchers. So from a legislative standpoint, we have a bill called the ACRE Act, which is the Access to Credit for Our Rural Economy Act. In essence, would lower interest rates by removing the taxation on farm real estate and rural housing and aquaculture. So we get a nice trifecta there. But it would lower interest rates, we estimate, at 50 to 150 basis points, which is the biggest thing our banks are talking about right now, where interest rates are, how they matter, how it's affecting their customers. So we came up and have been working on legislation that helps that issue.
The evolving conversation around lending priorities has also been shaped by ongoing shifts in the agricultural landscape.
I think the biggest thing is the cost of ag continues to increase every single year. I was joking with somebody earlier, I don't think it's gone down in a long time. So when you look at the cost of ag increasing, an older farm population, I guess the big things that have changed for us is how do we support our customers going forward, and how do we deal with this large ag transition that's going to happen in the next few years? Every single year, the age of farmers increases by more than a year, so which tells you that we're accelerating into that next generation faster than we think we are.
The farm bill, and specifically its credit title, remains a priority.
on a priority standpoint, the credit title is where we spend the most time. We want to increase the FSA farm ownership and farm operating loan programs. They're currently a lot smaller than we'd like them to be. They're about $2 million. We want to increase them to $3.5 on ownership and $3 million on operating. Why? And it'll lead into the second thing we care about. Ag costs more. It's harder to get operations up and running. Iowa and Missouri are having contests for who can spend the most on land right now. And we're trying to set up our credit to make sure that we can help those beginning farmers especially get into ag.
Elfman says they're advocating for increased FSA loan programs and initiatives to support beginning farmers. This is the AgNet NewsHour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. We will return in just a moment with more of the day's national headlines and local reports, including our livestock report with Will Jordan, when we return. You're listening to the AgNet NewsHour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. In today's national spotlight, the Agriculture Secretary Thursday announced available assistance as part of a distressed borrowers initiative focused on farm and emergency loan borrowers. Rod Bain reports.
The latest in efforts to assist distressed farm loan borrowers impacted by events such as emergencies or pandemic.
1,300 borrowers, we're going to provide some level of relief, assistance, and resources.
Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack at South Carolina State University Thursday announcing approximately $208 million in automatic financial assistance will be available for qualifying farm and emergency loan borrowers. $80 million of assistance will go to borrowers with qualifying guaranteed loans flagged for liquidation as of November 30th, while the remaining amount covers borrowers with current outstanding direct emergency loans. The secretary says this is the latest action within the Distress Borrowers Initiative.
To date, over 31,000 borrowers who have done business with USDA, either through a direct loan or through a guaranteed loan at a bank that's guaranteed by the USDA, have received over $1.7 billion of assistance to become current on their loans to provide them the opportunity to breathe a little easier.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
After a day of competitive bid calling in Paris, Kentucky, 10 more auctioneers advanced to the World Livestock Auctioneer Championship. The qualifiers, led by Daniel Mitchell from Cumberland, Ohio, will compete in the semifinals at the Oklahoma National Stockyards in June. Bob Cervera shares more.
A packed house at Paris Stockyards November 16th. Bidders, buyers, and spectators watch 37 auctioneers from throughout the country vie for top honors. In addition to belt buckles, the field competed for a chance to advance to World Livestock Auctioneer Championship semifinals in Oklahoma City. In the end, Daniel Mitchell came out on top. The bid caller from the Buckeye State said it was exciting and humbling to win, especially against tough competition. But even if he hadn't come out on top, it's a great time.
The competition is always exciting. They say the people that has the best chance are cattle auctioneers because of the rhythmic ability and moving fast and repetition of that. So I think it's so popular with people because it's a very pleasing sound to hear. The people like to hear the speed, the rhythm, and try to keep up with that.
It was especially fun for qualifier event judge Michael Dominic to see the next generation of livestock auctioneers.
Well, I think it's good to see the young blood that's coming up and to see what's going to take over in the future. And so these guys are all on the cutting edge of where the industry's going and what they're doing. And for me, that's an exciting thing to watch.
But the contest isn't all fun and games. It's a unique opportunity to spotlight an integral part of the livestock industry. Reserve champion Preston Smith from Imperial, Nebraska says the WLAC events are an important educational and promotional tool for businesses like his.
You know, we get to showcase what we can do. I mean, a lot of people, 20 years ago, they didn't know what all livestock sale barns went through, and especially the auctioneer. And it just brought us out to the front and said, this is what we do for our customers. This is what we're doing for our people, our buyers, our sellers.
For Livestock Marketing Association, I'm Bob Cervera.
That's today's National Spotlight. Now here's Will Jordan with today's Livestock Report.
In today's Livestock News, it's no secret that U.S. beef is the preferred protein domestically and abroad. and Asia is ever expanding as a major market for U.S. red meat exports. As a multi-billion dollar valued export region, new market access expands export trade and adds more value to cattle on the hoof. With trading relations extending back to the 1990s, demographic shifts and buying power increases on the Asian continent demand that U.S. beef stay on the minds of Asian consumers as we compete with other nations for market share. I visited with Alexis Taylor, USDA Undersecretary for Trade and Foreign Agricultural Affairs, to learn more about the growing Asian export market.
Yeah, I think we are known for high-quality beef. It certainly is a different product, being predominantly grain-fed. And there's a real drive for consumers who are interested in these high-quality products from the U.S. But at the same time, a lot of these markets also take products that we don't necessarily eat in the United States. So it really maximizes the entire part of that animal for our producers, which I think is so important. Japan has long been a top market. It's going to continue to be, and I think the changes we had late last year to expand access into the Japanese market is critical. But we have to look beyond them to Southeast Asia is really exciting. Countries like Vietnam, Malaysia, which I was just in, they have young populations, they've got growing middle classes, booming economies. What's the one thing that people do when they start making more money is they look to diversify their food products, what they're buying on their plate. And I think U.S. producers have a real opportunity to capitalize on this early on because everybody else in the world knows these demographic changes as well, and they're in there competing against us.
Though trading with Japan for decades, South Korea has remained the top destination for U.S. beef exports in 2023. Competition on the global beef market is fierce as Australia has garnered favor and a major share of the beef market in Asian nations as of late. As currency exchange rates have climbed over the past several years, U.S. beef has become expensive for Asian consumers, opening the door to Australian trade. Australian exports of beef to South Korea and China have increased by 20 and 40% respectively, and year-over-year unit value of beef exports to Asia from Australia is recorded as lower. Put simply, Australian beef is hitting the meat case at a lower price than U.S. beef. Along with the work of USDA's Foreign Agricultural Service, the United States Meat Export Federation works hard to promote beef internationally using promotion investments from the Beef Checkoff. Nonetheless, a recent report by USDA's Economic Research Service and World Agricultural Outlook Board forecast a more disappointing 2024 for foreign exports as the demand outlook from Asia is revised as lower than previously expected.
For Agnet West, I'm Will Jordan.
This is the Agnet News Hour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. We will return in just a moment with more agriculture news. Coming up in a few moments, we'll have today's This Land of Ours report. But first, more of the day's agriculture news. And with today's Agnet West headlines, here's Agnet West Farm News Director, Brian German.
The U.S. Department of Agriculture's updated its forecast for food prices. USDA economist Megan Schweitzer spoke to the new food price inflation projections for 2023.
So for food at home or grocery prices, we're predicting prices to increase 5.2% in 2023. We're expecting all food prices to increase by 5.8%. And for restaurant prices, we're predicting food away from home prices to increase by 7.1%.
USDA also has a new food price forecast for 2024.
We expect food prices to continue to decelerate its growth, but we don't expect food prices to decline overall in 2024. We expect grocery prices to increase by 1.6%. We expect prices for all food to increase by 2.9%. And we expect prices for food away from home to increase by 4.3%.
The first part of the Clean Truck Check rule from the California Air Resources Board is set to come into effect. Director of Regulatory and Environmental Affairs for Western United Dairies, Paul Souza, explained the first requirement being implemented as part of the rule.
The actual smog checking is not going to occur until the second half of 2024. So what you've got to do right now is get your truck registered in this database by the end of the year and pay a $30 fee per truck, but you won't actually have to do a smog check until the second half of 2024. And so I suggest, going to ARB's website, and there is a lot of information there. There is information on how to register your truck in that database. There's a video tutorial kind of walk you through how to set up an account and how to enter your truck's information. That database is open and available for folks to start getting in there and entering their trucks.
Starting with clean plant material is vital for protecting grapevines from disease. Cooperative Extension Specialist in Plant Pathology Akeep Eskelin explained why starting clean is essential for growers.
So let's say when the growers found the clean plant material from the nurseries, they put them on the ground. If they do not protect the pruning wound when it is in the field, at that winter, after dormant pruning, they will get the infection because spores of these grapevine trunk diseases are in the air, in the soil. So that means that we have to start with the clean plant material and then keep it clean. By the time when our growers see the disease, it's kind of too late. Pathogen is there. And also keep in your mind that for the plant pathology, preventative of the disease are more important than control, because curing or controlling is most difficult thing on the plant diseases.
The U.S. EPA has released several proposals regarding its Endangered Species Act commitments under its pesticide program. California Fresh Food Association's Adam Borchard said a lot of work remains to be done in fine-tuning some of the proposals.
For instance, on the recent herbicide policy US EPA issued, Western agriculture was defined as west of Interstate 35 and east of US Highway 395. Well, that excludes the vast majority of California's agricultural region. So there's a lot of work that remains to be done. I mean, fortunately, US agriculture has risen to the challenge and provide substantive comments to US EPA on these rather complex but also problematic potential regulations on industry, not just on the restaurants, but also on production agriculture.
UC Agriculture and Natural Resources is hosting the San Joaquin Valley Grape Symposium next month in Fresno County. The symposium is taking place Wednesday, January 10th at the CPDES Hall in Easton. The program begins with a discussion on Sunpreme raisins on different trellis, rootstocks, and nutrient scenarios, followed by an update on laws and regulations from the Fresno County Ag Commissioner's Office. After the morning break, plant pathologist Dr. Akeep Eskelin will be presenting information on grapevine powdery mildew and bunch rot management. Updates will also be provided on the USDA ARS and the Bloom Fresh raisin breeding programs. The event will finish up with a grower panel discussion on natural dry-on-the-vine raisin varieties. More information about the symposium is available on the upcoming events page at agnetwest.com. I'm Brian German for Agnet West Radio Network.
And now Andy Peterson shares a key update from the pork industry on preparedness for and prevention of African swine fever.
In order to fully appreciate and evaluate where we currently stand, we have to know where we've been. And we get that on African Swine Fever from good Iowa Ag Matters advocate Dr. Paul Sundberg, the retiring director of the Swine Health Information Center.
I'll tell you, we got into China in 2018, and we sat down with USDA at that time and looked at them right across the table and said, "What's your plan?" And they went, "Well, we don't have one yet. So... there's been a lot of progress. They've really done a good job. We are more prepared for African swine fever than we've ever been prepared for anything in history. That being said, the issue is preventing it.
He says that work continues.
And that's a big effort. That's something that goes all the way from USDA to Customs and Border Protection, to state animal health officials and state veterinarians, to farmers. And it's got to be a group effort. None of those can do it by themselves. It's got to be a group effort. And we've made an awful lot of progress since 2018.
In regard to where those efforts are currently focused,
our pork industry does not have a credible traceability system, national traceability system for our pigs. That's something we're working on. National Pork Producers Council, National Pork Board, everybody's working together.
As at any given point, at any given day, there's about 2.2 million hogs on the road that would need to be stopped should an outbreak of African swine fever occur.
Don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you just need to catch the news at a different time, you can subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search for Agnet NewsHour on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's Agnet NewsHour, and it is available on both Apple and Android devices. We will return in just a moment with more agriculture news. Welcome back to the Agnet NewsHour. There's still plenty of time to send or receive holiday gifts of perishable foods. An expert has tips on how to do that safely. Gary Crawford has more.
Ah, it's that time of year again. Jingle bells and the giving and getting of wonderful holiday gifts.
Ah, humbug.
Oh, no, I don't want humbug. Maybe hamburger patties or any kind of food. Or as a classic cartoon character Woody Woodpecker said about getting or stealing food.
Oh, boy! Food! That's my favorite dish.
Yeah, mine too. Many of us like to make food items and ship them to friends and family. This time of year, some of us have friends or relatives who order from companies, things like steaks and all kinds of perishable foods to be delivered to us, or we order to deliver to them. However,
you really have to focus on keeping the food at a safe temperature, especially if it's something raw, especially if it's perishable.
After all, we are perishable. This from Meredith Carruthers with the Agriculture Department's Meat and Poultry Hotline, the number of which we'll give you in a minute. So let's say you are the sender of a perishable food item. Meredith says, first, cold is your friend.
Dry ice or any kind of cold source that's going to last that duration of sending is going to be really important, or making sure you're picking a shipping option that will get it there quicker and still allow it to be kept cold.
Keeping that food below 40 degrees for the entire trip to its destination, that is vital.
Because once you've hit 2 hours at room temperature, it's no longer safe.
Any bacteria in or on the food can multiply quickly and make people sick. Next, once you've packaged that food.
Right. On the package, contains perishables, so that way delivery people or the person receiving the package knows that it contains something that needs to be put into a safe environment.
And don't try to surprise the recipient of that food item.
Make sure your people that you're sending things to know that it's coming so they can prepare accordingly. Or if they aren't going to be there, they have somebody who can help take the package for them and get it into a safe environment.
Let's flip-flop that. Say you are the recipient of a gift or some sort of perishable food item.
First things first, you'll want to check to make sure those cold sources have still been keeping the food cold. If you receive any kind of perishables that feel warm or don't have any kind of cold sources present, we wouldn't recommend to use it because that means it most likely hasn't been kept at a safe temperature for a prolonged period of time.
Of course, sometimes you may not be sure. It feels maybe a little cool, maybe. Then what?
We really recommend trying to use a food thermometer and sticking it in the food to see what that temperature of the product is. Because if it's still below 40 degrees, that means it's still safe. If it's above 40 degrees, there's a chance that it's no longer safe to use.
Don't take chances with that. And Meredith says, if there's any doubt, call the Meat and Poultry Hotline or go online to ask.usda.gov.
And we can help work through that situation with you to make sure we're keeping you as safe as possible.
Hotline number is 1-888-MP-HOTLINE, 1-888-MP-HOTLINE, or go online to ask.usda.gov. Gary Crawford reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
With Christmas fast approaching, 'tis the season to be baking, and this is a peak season for sugar use in commercial bakeries and in consumer kitchens. But Western Canada is experiencing a major shortage of granulated sugar as a strike at the Rogers Sugar Refinery in Vancouver drags into its third month. Dennis Guy has more.
The Canadian market is served by just 3 sugar refineries. Eastern Canadians are experiencing no sugar supply shortages for Redpath Sugar in Toronto, Canada's largest refinery, and for the Rogers Sugar Plant in Montreal, it's business as usual. But workers at Rogers Sugar Plant in Vancouver have been on strike since September. The plant is operating at severely reduced capacity. Constant Pop owns a chocolate confectionery bakery shop in Vancouver.
It was probably about 3 weeks ago we started getting shorted from our wholesaler is when we started going to Costco early in the morning and just trying to check out what they have there and stocking up there. I just worry as our demand for baked good increase that we won't be able to get what we need and we will potentially be missing out on those sales.
While the Rogers plant in Montreal is sending what it can to Vancouver to help supply the Western market, those supplies are limited as this is a peak demand season for sugar across the country. The union representing the Vancouver Sugar Plant Public and Private Workers of Canada says its workers are at odds with Rogers Sugar over issues including wages, benefits, and the company's wanting to increase its refinery operation to 3 shifts on an ongoing basis year-round. Adrian Soldera is president of Public and Private Workers of Canada, Local Branch 8 in Vancouver.
It's not an ideal situation for the union, and it's not an ideal situation for the company, especially around Christmas time. The price of a single bag of sugar has been raised significantly for these customers, so they're hurting, everyone's hurting, everyone has families, everyone wants to make money.
A mediator hopes to bring the two parties together later this week after more than a month away from the bargaining table. But even if the dispute is resolved, industry watchers say sugar shortages will continue as production capacity comes back online. Edgar Semler operates a bakery in Winnipeg, and he says a 50-pound bag of white sugar has doubled over the past month. But regardless of the current price of sugar, Semler thinks his supply, and for the home baker, the shortage will be in place right through Christmas.
Our number one ingredient is flour. I think number two is sugar. I think for the home baker, we're going to be in trouble right through Christmas. So our price was $26 for 20 kilos, and that price from some of our distributors has jumped over $60.
Reporting from Canada, I'm Dennis Guy.
Don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you just need to catch the news at a different time, you can subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search for AgNet NewsHour on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's AgNet NewsHour, and it is available on both Apple and Android devices. We'll be back in just a moment with more agriculture news. Welcome back to the AgNet NewsHour. Chuck Zimmerman has today's interview segment. Here's Chuck.
I'm visiting with Andy Levine with the American Seed Trade Association. Andy, we've got a big conference coming up very soon here, the Field Crop Seed Conference. First time with this name and in a new location, Orlando. So give us a little bit of a preview of this year's conference.
Well, after 72 years in Chicago, and we kind of needed a new location. Now, Orlando was a great opportunity for us to get down there, a very attractive place. We're excited about it. The conference is set up, so it's very conducive to going to the expo floor and interacting with the exhibitors during the conference. Everything is right around the expo floor, so we're super psyched to see how that goes. Easy access in and out of the Orlando airport, so all around, we're looking forward to a great show this year. We've got good registration. It continues to increase, and we hope to have great numbers this year.
The name change, what triggered that?
Well, when we look at it, we're working with a lot more than the old name was corn and sorghum and soybean. We also have cotton at this meeting. We have rice at this meeting. We have wheat at this meeting. So there's a lot of other row crops that are out there. So we really felt field crop seed was one that fit more appropriate all of the seeds that we represent.
So will we see changes in the way things are scheduled and maybe some of the kinds of speakers we might have?
Well, this year we're starting out with senior leadership from the four big corn and soybean seed companies and really them looking at the future. Some of the structure is going to be the same. We'll have Dan Bossi back giving that global perspective on ag economics and the global marketplace. But then we'll have some other ones on training and education and communications. A little bit more, I would say, heft in the schedule this year with respect to leadership issues.
How are things looking with the trade show portion of this?
Trade show floor, last we looked, is about 91 or 92% sold out. I was just at another meeting in Indianapolis and had two people come to me there wanting to get a booth and see if we still had space available. So there's still space attracted. There are some people who are kind of looking at it this year. How much equipment do we bring or other things? They want to see what the traffic is like. And so we'll probably see an even bigger footprint next year.
Well, I just have a gut feeling that Florida is a good place in the month of December. So what's your anticipation?
Well, we anticipate sunny 60 to 70 degree weather for the week that we're there, so we're excited about that. And it gives companies the opportunity to work with their clients and their customers in different venues, you know, whether it's a sporting venue or whether it's an attraction in that area. We're right in the middle of a lot of things that are easily accessible.
Well, and I would say that, you know, for people that might want to bring families, you know, along, good place to be doing that, right?
Well, it is, and it's a good time. You're past the Thanksgiving holiday, and you're right before the Christmas holidays. You know, if you can get your family away for a long weekend, there's not a better time in the parks in that short window between those two holidays.
Tell us a little bit about what the priorities have been for this year. And, you know, we're coming near to a close, so where do things stand?
Well, a couple of things that we're working on. One is plant breeding policy with respect to the agencies that regulate our industry. So it's USDA, EPA, and FDA, trying to determine what the U.S. policy is going to be for techniques like gene editing as we bring in new techniques into the breeding process. And it's been a challenge. They're all different now, and we've got to try to figure out how to get some harmonization between them so it doesn't restrict research and innovation into the future. So that's a key one. Seed treatment policy continues to be a challenge. There's some opposition out there in the NGO community on use of seed treatment, especially in corn and beans and cotton. And we need to make sure that we're working closely with EPA and USDA on what they're thinking and where they're going, as well as down at the state level, because we're seeing a lot of state-level activity in that. And then the conservation side. Sustainability is a big issue, and within sustainability, you look at practices, you look at cover crops and other things, and how is that going to continue to grow? There's a lot of incentives in the public and private marketplace for farmers to plant cover crops and rotate in cover crops into their operation. So those are some of the big things that we've been working on.
Well, on the political front, Farm Bill is probably the one that has at least a little bit of news at this point. So we will have, assuming it's signed, an extension.
Yeah, we anticipate. The Senate passed theirs last night with the Farm Bill extension in it, so we anticipated going to the president's desk today. He's got to sign it by Friday, so he's got a couple of days to look at that, but we anticipate that he'll sign that as well. Gives us that one-year breathing period. Going into a presidential election, we really don't have a one-year breathing period. We're going to need to get it done early in 2024 so that the politics of the presidential don't overtake passage and we don't have to go for another extension. So our push, and I think most of the agricultural community's push, will be let's get it done early, let's get it put to bed so that we have another 5 years guaranteed and we don't worry about the politics.
I've heard it said that this hasn't been the most exciting farm bill that we've had. Does it seem that way?
Yeah, I think because of the politics around D.C. these days and where we are with appropriations and change in administration and where their priorities were, getting an infrastructure bill out, getting the Inflation Reduction Act out, and the environmental monies that were made available there for the farm community. A lot of those, I think, took some of the wind out of the sails of farm bill discussions and debate to the benefit of the agriculture community to some extent, but it sort of pulled that off of that debate. And then lack of additional resources. So in research, we could really use some more research dollars going to our land-grant institutions and other research institutions for agriculture. But that's going to be tight. Probably will stay the same, which means we're falling behind. So I think some of those things really just took the wind out of the sails of the farm bill discussion and debate.
Well, Andy, it's good to talk to you here. And I'm Chuck Zimmerman reporting.
This is the AgNet NewsHour. We will return in just a moment with more agriculture.
You are listening to the AgNet NewsHour.
And now for more news, aviation fuels could be a big part of the future of renewable energy. David Geiger has this report.
There is a push towards clean energy in the U.S. The Biden administration is looking at solar, wind, and electric vehicles, but also biofuel for aviation. Secretary of Agriculture Tom Vilsack.
The reality is you're not going to be flying in a battery-powered plane. You're not going to be flying in a hydrogen powered plane for a long, long time. You're going to be flying in a low carbon fuel plane. And that low carbon fuel is sustainable aviation fuel, and it is a 36 billion gallon industry that does not exist for all intents and purposes today.
A great opportunity, according to Americans for Clean Aviation Fuel States Director Nick Boink.
And I think we are really at the first step, and an important advocacy step to really launch this.
Boink is excited for the next few years as they launch the latest renewable industry initiative. He thinks this new product will be similar to another one gaining traction.
This is like E15, and we have, just about every car on the road able to utilize that fuel. We see this as, an opportunity to have a full shift into clean aviation fuel for the years ahead. Some infrastructure will go into that shift, but we see this as a vast, giant global market that is going to start really here with the existing Iowa agriculture industry and be pivotal in that market across the whole country.
Iowa is the number one producer of ethanol in the nation, 4.4 billion gallons in 2021. It was the source of about a third of U.S. production, and it makes a sixth of the world's biofuel. And excluding Brazil, Iowa produced nearly as much as the rest of the world combined. So it makes sense Americans for Clean Aviation Fuel, a coalition that started just this month, has its state's director based there.
Based in Iowa, born and raised in Iowa, and have many friends across Iowa that are going to be working in the industry that's important to clean aviation fuel of the future. It's a national coalition that's uniting a whole host of diverse industries, which is what is unique about it. The meeting of the aviation, the manufacturing, the energy, and our agricultural industry all in one.
ACAF is planning education campaigns and promoting the impact of clean aviation fuel. Vilsack says aviation could be twice the size of the existing biofuels industry.
If that industry supports 400,000 jobs, do the math. There's a tremendous opportunity just in sustainable aviation fuel. There are actually 40,000 products that potentially could be available in this space as we transition from an economy that's based primarily on fossil fuel production to an economy that's more balanced.
Boink agrees there's huge potential.
I think really the sky's the limit, you know, pun intended here. And as that relates to, say, job creation, you know, not just economic impact, but job creation in itself, you know, a recent report from the Air Transport Action Group estimated 14 million new jobs that don't exist today or are currently today will be sustained by the shift to clean aviation fuels alone. And that's not to mention the impact on the American supply chain and the viability that this offers the Iowa and the American family farmer.
Reporting from Des Moines, Iowa, I'm David Geiger.
USDA has released a new forecast for this year's farm income. Gary Crawford has more.
This is kind of our best guess here in terms of how we're going to finish out the year.
USDA's Economic Research Service Administrator Spiro Stefano talking about USDA's latest farm income forecast for 2023, a year in which producers have seen a big drop in cash receipts and in net profits. USDA now projecting net cash farm income this year just under $158 billion, down 21% from the record high of last year.
But still, the farm sector remains fairly healthy in terms of its solvency.
He says, yes, farm debt is increasing, but the value of farm assets growing faster than debt. Also,
bankruptcy rates have continued to fall.
From a rate 5 years ago of about 3 bankruptcies for every 10,000 farms down to less than 1 per 10,000 this year. So, Spiro Stefano says 2023 farm income will be down from last year, but it's still above the average for the last 20 and is helping produce what he calls
a fairly healthy financial situation for the farm sector.
Gary Crawford reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
As 2023 is coming to an end, Rod Bain takes a look at the year's wildfire totals around the nation. Here's Rod.
Thanksgiving week precipitation put a damper on mid-Atlantic wildfires that consumed over 16,000 acres in Virginia and North Carolina. USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey says even with that significant November wildfire activity,
we are coming to the end of, at least on paper, one of the most quiet wildfire seasons that we have seen in a generation.
The National Interagency Fire Center notes that with November's end,
we have seen less than 2.6 million acres of vegetation burned in the United States so far in 2023.
If those numbers hold, 2023 would be the smallest annual wildfire acreage consumption since 1998.
A year that 1.3 million acres burned across the country.
Contrasting the quiet activity in the western and central U.S., our nation's deadliest wildfire in a century, the Lahaina Fire in Hawaii, took place this year. I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
That's today's top agriculture news. I'm Sabrina Halverson. Thank you for sharing your morning with us.
To get more information on the topics you heard today, visit AgNet West online at agnetwest.com. You can also stay connected by following us on our social media at AgNet West on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can also find our broadcast team of Danielle Leal, Brian German, and Sabrina Halverson on Facebook and Twitter. Thank you for listening to the AgNet NewsHour from AgNet West. AgNet West Radio Network, your primary choice for agriculture news.